It is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. 2 years ago, Governor Tony Evers signed an executive order creating the Governor's Task Force on Broadband Access to advise him on how to expand high-speed internet access to every home, every business and institution in the state. In announcing the task force, he described how people shifted overnight to virtual learning and work from home.
We changed how we live, work, and learn in order to adapt to this virus, which has highlighted the digital divide in our state.
Courtesy Wisconsin Eye, the task force is now out with its second annual report. Join in on broadband access and connectivity challenges and breakthroughs through the years, 800-642-1234. Brittany Beyer is Executive Director of Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation, and she chairs the Governor's Task Force on Broadband Access. Brittany, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me again.
Well, let's take stock of 2 years, of this task force work. What can you point to as your biggest step forward in connecting people and businesses and access to high-speed internet?
Well, I think the biggest step forward comes from the federal government with the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. So I might say IIJA sometimes. But that was a real big condition change on our side. There's $1 trillion of investment in infrastructure, including broadband, which is going to change the landscape for everyone.
So you're really looking at those federal dollars. So in year two of your task force, has that really been your primary focus, is figuring out where those federal dollars should go?
Yes, I would say the second report is really an addendum to the first. I believe the IIJA, the infrastructure bill, was not out yet when we did the first report. Mm-hmm. And then it was decided that it was going to go forward. So then the second report became, okay, now that the landscape has changed, what we're doing great investment on the state side, what happens with these very close to us dollars coming down? How are we going to use those best?
The task force, you put that into numbers, highlighting $289 million for broadband expansion since Governor Evers took office in 2019. And that includes the $100 million from the American Rescue Plan Act. How, you know, has the money started paying for expansion in Wisconsin? How do you see it put to work?
All of those programs were grant related programs on the local level. So many communities, many providers applied for those funds to do build outs across the whole entire state. And some of those are already in operation. And some of those, especially the ones that were just announced this past June at the very end, they're just getting started probably in the next 6 months.
So is that lawmakers approving $125 million for broadband expansion as part of the current budget? Is that separate from that, where the PSC, the Public Service Commission, awarded 71 grants last month?
That is included in that $280 million that you were just speaking about. So that $125 million, that is part of that the large investment that the state has made, actually.
So as you look at these dollars coming in, how difficult is it for communities at the local level to get these awards and put those dollars into expansion work? Because you have to connect those, you know, a lot of different aspects here, from federal, state, and then into those local communities.
Right. So, you know, you just alluded to how complex this is, and you're asking local communities and providers of small and large size to act a little bit differently. So you are asking them to rapidly learn a new way of working. And that was actually a real strong focus of the task force's conversations and output this time around. And we spoke about it in the first report in the active network building, but that became, again, the focus because it's going to change the landscape so much.
We're talking about expanding broadband access in the state. 2 years of task force work with Brittany Beyer, who chairs the governor's task force on broadband access. You can join in on connectivity, what you see in your own community, and where Wisconsin goes in the future. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brittany, can you give us a sense how the federal dollars will be put to work, as opposed to what state dollars might be able to leverage? Will they be the same thing, or will they go to different aspects of broadband build out?
Well, the design of the infrastructure law is that the money flows down to the federal level, down to the state level. The PSC is working through their plan for what they're going to do with the roughly $45 million that they're going to be receiving. And then there's more coming for the actual grants. On that level, those dollars are going to be flowing down to a certain degree for planning in around the whole entire state. There will be need to continue state funding in broadband because there's this little tricky thing where you can't match federal dollars with federal dollars. So the state of Wisconsin is really going to have to keep something open on their side for the communities to do matching. But then also not everyone is going to be deemed underserved or they will have the ability to use those federal grants. So they will have to keep a pocket for themselves at the state level to dole out that way.
So what might be a community that has enough resources or would be excluded from a grant opportunity? Can you give it more of an example there?
I don't know if I can give you concrete examples because the federal level is redoing the maps and they will not be out until the fall. And so a big concern has been that the mapping is not granular enough. The federal government has heard that. So they're redoing the mapping process. There is a challenge process as well with that. So I'm just going to say, for example, a community that has a couple of different providers and fairly good access, they're probably not going to be the community that has the federal dollars going to it. If it's just beyond, let's say on the outskirts of that town, where some of the connectivity becomes spotty, that part might be part of the infrastructure law dollars. I just can't say for certain, but mm-hmm. I think it's also really important to note that there will be an ability for the communities to challenge that. And so having good software and mapping techniques to be able to challenge that in a way that is going to have good outcome, that's something that the state is also working through as well.
Yes, because the Public Service Commission has also worked on this mapping issue to try to get more detailed, as you mentioned, granular data to figure out where the gaps are. So how is that work progressing?
I think on the state side, it's progressing. It is the providers are willingly giving them better information. It's when the state, that when the federal government is going to take that extra step, that's going to move all of the providers into one direction that then gives you the comprehensive mapping that covers everything. I will give a caveat that some communities are feeling like that might not be granular enough still. And so there needs to be, again, something that the local communities, I would say at county levels in my mind, should really become stewards of their own local understanding of broadband, kind of like with infrastructure and roads.
We're checking in on the governor's task force to address broadband access in our state. A working group 2 years in just published its second annual report. Brittany Beyer there, chair, leads Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation. Join in on how you think Wisconsin has done in broadband expansion, assistance to customers and businesses, the tech side of it, how you want federal funding used, whether your community has gone after a grant and what that outcome was. 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're checking in on the governor's task force on broadband access that was formed 2 years ago, out with their second broadband annual report. It says that since Governor Tony Evers took office in 2019, Wisconsin has allocated or disbursed over $289 million to expand broadband. The Public Service Commission, the PSC, houses the state broadband office. It estimates 650,000 residents still lack access to high-speed internet. Maybe you're one of them. Join in on connectivity, on access and cost, 800-642-1234. Brittany Beyer chairs the 27-member Governor's Task Force and stays with us. Brittany, one of the recommendations of your report is to develop a statewide digital navigator program to help underconnected people and solve a lot of issues there. How would this work? What do you envision?
Well, again, this is one of the moments where the infrastructure law is going to help us out immensely. The infrastructure law has specifically carved out for a digital equity program statewide. So again, because this is all fairly new, the PSC is currently working on what that will look like. They have been working for over a year on digital equity already, working with stakeholders and hearing what they really need on the ground. But it really would probably look like partnering with existing nonprofit organizations who are doing the work with their different communities, working with associations who are working with different populations, including those who have different abilities and need concerted efforts towards them. It will be funding them, giving them the resources, and making sure that their programs are designed to further connection on that side.
And this is not just about rural areas. This is about urban as well, I would imagine.
Absolutely. A lot of the adoption process really is across the whole entire state. You're talking about people who have different hindrances to being able to use the computers that we use every single day, have financial inability to get that access as well. We have to be thinking about that. And you are very right. It's on the urban side as well as the rural side.
Back in 2020, there was that Connectors pilot program that you had launched, really helping communities with, technical aid. And you had such an overwhelming response. What did that tell you about the state's needs?
Well, it was the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation and the PSC doing that work. And it popped back up in our conversation because it is very important. What I see from that and what you will read in the report is that we certainly believe that that expanded technical assistance for the communities has to be part of the state's response in how they're going to use those infrastructure law dollars for all of the communities for those planning efforts. And so we spent a lot of time lifting up different stories from across the state in how communities got organized and worked with providers and really closed that gap. That is so beneficial. It moves the needle forward much quicker than it would in its own way. And if we are going to take advantage of this historic moment of investment, that has to be part of the planning structure. And again, the federal dollars that will be flowing through the PSC downward is exactly where that money could come from.
One of those stories, as you are so well aware, is the Reedsburg Utility Commission, bringing internet into their entire I guess, a span of of utilities. And this was nearly a generation ago. What does the Reedsburg story tell other communities?
It tells other communities that it's possible if they have an electric power organization inside of their community. One of the things that Reedsburg has done is made sure that Reedsburg itself is wired to a really great degree. They've been partnering with communities around them. And the model that they use is, because of the distance and they're taking on the cost of expansion, there's a slight monthly charge for each of those communities. It is a possibility. I would say not every community is going to be able to take advantage of that situation, but we as a state should really look at some of the legislative roadblocks to really thinking about that as a possibility. There's perfect examples of public-private partnership that are happening between providers and communities, but certainly Reedsburg is one of the ways that this could work.
We're talking about broadband access with Brittany Beyer, leads the governor's task force on broadband access, which formed 2 years ago under an executive order. You can join in on broadband, what you see with high-speed connectivity where you are. What are the challenges? What are barriers? 800-642-1234. Brittany, in the new report, the Public Service Commission Chair Rebecca Cameron-Bach calls broadband an essential service. Should then broadband be regulated like electricity or like water and other utilities?
I think that's something that we could certainly be fighting for. I think you should be talking to your federal representatives about that, because it will be a federal decision. And so if that is, I think a lot of us are talking about the connection to the internet as essential to the way that we work. I think there's a lot of work we have to do in order to get that point across. And it's just another way for us as individuals to connect with our federal representatives to really press that point.
I want to look more closely at your task force, 27 members or so, and you've been together now for a couple years. Where does Right. this task force go from here?
Well, I think the task force, I think so many people stayed on because it's such a really important issue. I will be stepping down from the chair role, but I'll probably still be involved because, again, it is really a really important issue. I think it's really important to note that this great work has been done almost 100% remotely. So we have had every single meeting on Zoom. Hmm. And so I think it's just a great way to think about what you can do in this new state of technology. A lot of people are afraid of what's going to happen in this hybrid space. And I think it's great to point to the good work that we've done completely remotely.
When do you plan to step down as chair?
I committed to turning into the next report. So we're talking about who that next chair will be. No decisions have been made, but I'm really excited to be working on the ground in my region with the knowledge that I've gained through this process. And again, I'll still stay involved with the task force.
Governor Evers has the goal to see all Wisconsin residents have broadband access by 2025. Are we on track to meet that goal?
I think to a certain degree we are, but I think you can kind of think broader with the infrastructure law, that five-year term. You know, I think a lot of people are feeling such anxious desire for the gap to be closed as soon as possible. I think the note is people are definitely working on it, but the federal dollars are going to be flowing over a five-year process. And it's just important that whatever level of government that's appropriate for really being a good partner on at the table, they need to know that they have to have a sense of urgency that the state and the federal government have at this point, too. So it's going to take everyone to close this gap.
We only have a few seconds left. How's connectivity where you are in the Rhinelander area?
In the Rhinelander area, it's pretty good. It's, again, right outside of those main areas. I would say we're seeing great work from our county level representatives in multiple counties, Vilas, Oneida, Forest, who have put together really competitive grants and won them. And we have a lack of middle mile. We didn't talk about that. So the projects are more expensive up here, but we're really aware that we need to take very, very aggressive steps to close those gaps.
Brittany, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a good morning.
You too. Brittany Beyer, Executive Director of Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation in Rhinelander, chairs Governor Evers' Task Force on Broadband Access. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore school safety now and the Department of Public Instruction's approach. The State Department of Justice last month created 12 regional teams to support schools around the state to deal with critical incidents like school shootings. This is from Education Week's school shooting tracker. There have been 27 school shootings with injuries or deaths this year. Uvalde, Texas, Robb Elementary, the deadliest since Sandy Hook in 2012. Join in 800-642-1234. Jill Underley is State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Superintendent Underley, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. As we mark 8 weeks since Uvalde, 19 children, two teachers, how does the school massacre affect your preparations for return to school this fall?
Well, I think I need to just preface it with the fact that these are just appalling and just beyond our imagination, these kinds of events that happen, but they're becoming such a daily occurrence in the United States. The Department of Justice in Wisconsin and the Department of Public Instruction were separate. So when you mentioned how the DOJ has created these response teams, that's separate from what DPI would be doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The acknowledgement that school shootings happen anywhere in the United States, and we need to say, rather than saying that we need to do more to defend our schools, I think we need to protect our children by really examining and changing our access to guns. And that being said, I mean, teachers go to work every day with the specter, honestly, of one day this could happen here in our school. And that's really not okay. And our kids live with that trauma, whether they witness the violence or whether they see it on the news or whatnot. And so at the department, we really try to step up more social, emotional, mental health resources, as well as counseling when we can.
You made a really important distinction that Department of Public Instruction separate from what is happening at DOJ in the Office of School Safety. How closely are you working with the Office of School Safety?
We don't work very closely with them. We have our own, our own wheelhouse, I should say. And our charge is to educate kids. And to train teachers and to license teachers. When it comes to school safety outside of facilities, and certainly working with, trying to look at developing more secure entrances and those kinds of things, the training piece on school safety is really the Department of Justice's, that's their purview.
When you talk about entrances, Uvalde, the gunman entered the school through a door that could only be locked from the outside, then got inside a classroom, which the lock didn't work. That's come out in the testimony that we've been hearing in the Texas State Senate. What is DPI doing? And maybe this is outside of your agency, but what do you do about locks and school doors?
Well, I think we're kind of going around the issue here. The issue isn't, you know, somebody having access to our schools through, so we can lock our doors. It's just like your home, right? Or it could be like, you know, any place, you're a church or wherever you are. If a person wants to get in, they're going to get in. And we can, you know, we can do drills and we can do things like making sure that our doors are locked, but nothing is ever 100% guaranteed that it's going to work. There's always, you know, mechanical error or there's human error. And I think we're just losing sight of the fact that we have a person with a weapon that is designed to kill people, a high capacity automatic weapon. And we're losing sight of the fact that these individuals are allowed to just roam around our country and target whomever they want, whether it's in a mall, a restaurant, wherever it might be. And unfortunately, schools are like every other place in America that these events happen.
You've said that gun violence has led you to discuss issues that go further than traditional school policy. What do you mean by that? Where are you taking the conversation?
Well, I think, again, it's really that we have to look at our policies here in the United States, and that what we value more than the safety of our citizens and our most precious citizens are our children. You have to look at other countries. Yes, things like this do happen there, but they don't happen at nearly the frequency that they happen here. Other countries simply do not have that kind of access, and they don't have school shootings like we do. So then when we talk about school safety protocols, and when people ask me about these kinds of things, we have to remember that schools did not cause school shootings. It means that schools can't solve them. And it's the simple fact that rampant access to guns is what creates school shootings, and changing that access is where we need the solution.
We're talking about critical response in crisis public schools and school shootings. State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jill Underle with us. You can join in. What is your school doing well in regards to school safety? Where is it lacking? Join in at 800-642-1234. Superintendent, another separate aside here, the DOJ, Department of Justice, providing grants to schools for critical incident mapping. So schools can share their digital blueprints of their school layouts. Do you think, does critical incident mapping make schools safer?
I think it doesn't hurt to have information. You know, when our sheriff's department or whomever is going to be responding, I mean, I have to state, though, that since the Office of School Safety was established, I was a superintendent in the school district, and we had to give them our blueprint. We had to give both the DOJ and whoever would be the responding authority to our school a copy of our school blueprint. I think that certainly is helpful so that, you know, this, whoever is responding can have an idea of the layout of the building, where the classrooms are located. I don't think it hurts the situation, but
that's not just for school shootings. That could be a medical event or.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that happens all the time. Honestly, we would have authorities respond to our school for medical emergencies more than anything else, whether it was a Friday night game, you know, and there's a spectator or an athlete or whomever, or even during the day, you know, a child with an asthma attack or whatnot. But I think, you know, we have to look at the fact that these incidents happen in schools, they happen everywhere. And I think as a society, we need to embrace the fact that we all need to be prepared. And whether it means sharing blueprints or whether it means just sharing information, it's all helpful.
Let's spend a moment on school resource officers and your take there. Police officers in schools becoming more common. The National Center for Education Statistics reports about half of schools in the 2019-2020 academic year had a sworn officer carrying a firearm. Do officers in schools prevent violence against schools such as mass shootings?
I don't think they prevent violence such as mass shootings. I mean, certainly having more resources like SROs who are trained in mental health, building relationships, that's important. I mean, those are the individuals that we need in our building. I mean, if you look at school shootings that have happened, there have been school resource officers on site, or even, you know, with the most recent, with the Uvalde shooting, really quick response times, you know, quicker than if they had perhaps an SRO on their campus. And it still didn't prevent the school shooting. But what we need, honestly, in our schools, but maybe just in general, in this world, is more adults with more kindness who are out there to build relationships with kids, and to support kids. And I think that goes beyond SROs. It goes, you know, that's why everybody who works in a school works in a school. But it also goes beyond, you know, those who do our after school programs or those who actually make our laws. I mean, lawmakers, if they showed some compassion towards our schools and were able to give them some of the resources they needed, I think that would go a long way.
Days after Uvalde, a spokesperson for Assembly Speaker Robin Boss said that they were open to arming teachers as a school safety measure. What have you heard from teachers about the potential for allowing them to carry firearms?
So I think this really goes into my last statement, case in point, right? We need lawmakers and policymakers who show more compassion and kindness and really good solutions. And no, we should not be arming teachers. And I can't believe this is still discussed as a solution. And you think about those who have suggested this as a solution have never led a classroom, full stop. I mean, you would never allow one of your coworkers to be armed. And sometimes you just have to step back and admire the sheer stupidity of some of the solutions that our lawmakers offer, because what this does is it really distracts from the issue and takes the focus away from the issue, which is guns. And guns people have access to, and who has access to them. And I can't imagine a coworker of mine having a gun in the instance they'd have to shoot an intruder. But I think about it in other settings too. Think about your parish priest or your hairdresser or the clerk at the mall food court. I mean, simply having one is insane, and we shouldn't live in a society where that's our reality.
Jill Enderle, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, with us as we look at issues around school safety. Following the Uvalde school massacre, we spoke with Democratic Representative Deb Andraka, whose perspective is informed by being a gun owner and a former teacher.
If you've ever been in a classroom with 28 to 30 kids, you know that is not a place that you want any kind of firearm. And we have seen over and over again these proposals to arm schools, to arm teachers, to have more security there. They really just serve to distract us from the problem, which is easy access to guns.
Join in with your perspective on school safety, where we go from here, 800-642-1234. You're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. We zoom in on school safety measures. What's changing in Wisconsin with the State Superintendent of Public Instruction? Jill Enderle is here. Join in on issues like classroom and building security, parent communication, incidents of seclusion or restraint used on students, 800-642-1234. State Education Chief Jill Enderle with us for about 9 more minutes. Superintendent, in May, DPI released a report showing most students being placed in seclusion or physically restrained are students with disabilities. Why are these students being secluded or restrained more than others?
Sure. So seclusion and restraint, for those who don't know, are steps that are taken by staff to protect the safety of the student themselves and the safety of others. But we also need to acknowledge that they are very traumatic events for those very students. And we collect the data to gain an accurate picture of these practices in Wisconsin. And as we collect the data, it's really important to always remember that each instance is not just a data point, but their lived experiences for students and staff. And so students with disabilities they're subjected to these practices far more than their peers, and that's traumatic. When you think about students with disabilities, the data points show it's students with behavioral issues. It could be, you know, a lot of other reasons, but for students who are in these situations, I mean, it's definitely a last resort. And so we get this information so DPI is able to provide the tools that schools and districts need to prevent using it in the future. So we use it to inform our practice, to make things better so that we can reduce the use of this.
This is only the second year DPI has collected data on the use of seclusion and restraint. When will you be able to draw some conclusions?
So I think, you know, certainly school districts are doing this every year that they've collected it, but they've also been doing it long before DPI's, you know, had to collect it. You know, as a, like I shared before, I was the school district administrator. We shared this information locally with our school board, you know, just in a closed session so that they knew the numbers. But, you know, certainly it was looking at ways that we can integrate more social emotional learning skills into all areas of learning, helping other students certainly manage their feelings, build healthy relationships, navigate the different social environments. For many kids who have disabilities, school is extremely overwhelming. And so when schools become a trauma-sensitive school, that could certainly help students. And, you know, it's not just for students with disabilities, it's for the entire student body to help them build that social, emotional, and those academic skills.
Do you think our schools and people, teachers who work with children, getting adequate training on how to manage unruly or maybe dangerous behavior in a safer and less traumatic way?
Yeah, I do. I do feel that. I know, again, just, you know, from my own experience, we train teachers who are, you know, the primary teachers for students who are more likely to need this kind of seclusion and restraint. And again, it's not just used, you know, just willy-nilly. It's certainly used only as a last resort. And again, to make sure that the students don't harm themselves or others. And again, these individuals who use it are trained. And then the information is certainly used to just help make things better.
Your agency, the data reported to DPI, it's limited. It's not broken out by race or gender or age, other distinctions. It doesn't show how many restraints and seclusions were done by school staff versus mm-hmm. law enforcement. In the future, mm-hmm. will you require schools to improve transparency, perhaps, of this data tracking in future reports to DPI?
Well, I think we need to acknowledge that this is really sensitive information. And in smaller schools in particular, which 2/3 of Wisconsin schools are, you can pretty much, if you have some identifying information about a student, you can identify who the student is. Hmm. And so I feel that, in all honesty, again, these are just really traumatic events. They are part of growth. And again, it's just helping students be able to protect themselves and to keep themselves safe and others safe. And we use the information certainly to just inform our practices. But I don't feel that if we were to drill down even more and make that information more public, I mean, the school knows who the students are and they know the frequency. And I think that's all that matters.
We're talking about issues facing K-12 education in the height of summer, including IEPs, individualized education plans, school safety. Jill Underley is State Superintendent of Public Instruction in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Superintendent, in April, Wisconsin voters passed 65 referendums, totaling more than $860 million for school districts. And the referendums included proposals for new schools, for building upgrades. So as you watch inflation make the cost of operating or making these upgrades more expensive, how are you talking with schools about making adjustments to their budgets?
I think, you know, if people don't know this now, they're going to know this really soon, is that Wisconsin schools are going to have really difficult budgets in the next biennium and then the next year. And we have to look at the fact that our state is sitting on a surplus. I mean, those were tax dollars that we intended for our public services, like our schools, and they should be used exactly for that. And you think about the fact that our school finance formula hasn't been revised in over 30 years. And so since 1993 was the last time, and you think about how schools have changed dramatically in the last 30 years. You think about what's changed in our lives. I mean, technology, for example, assessments, how we staff our schools. And we just have so many more expenses. And you think about just technology alone. And then you have to also look at the condition of our school buildings. You have to factor in the costs of transportation and salary. And, or you think about, when I say the condition of our school buildings, the kids learn better and have a better learning experience, and people are able to teach better when we have climate controlled classrooms. And a lot of our schools don't have that. And so what you find is that our state is not giving the schools the resources they need. They're sitting on them, right? And our local taxpayers are faced with a choice. Our local taxpayers have to raise their own taxes in order to provide this high quality education for their community's children. And it's just so simply sad that we have a legislature that's willing to deprive not just our kids, but the people who work in those buildings, as well as our higher ed system, of these advances that they could offer them in our learning conditions.
We have less than a minute left. You mentioned salary. Is inflation causing more educators to leave schools for higher paying jobs elsewhere? What are you seeing in your ranks for teacher openings?
Yeah, there's a lot of teacher openings, but I don't want to blame it solely on inflation. I mean, we're in a staffing crisis, but it's also, you know, not just teachers, it's administrators, it's bus drivers, it's food staff, food service staff, it's custodial, all the people who make a school run. I mean, certainly COVID accelerated this, but working in a public school is an act of love, and we have to pay people what they're worth and respect them for the difficult job they're doing. And I think that lack of respect, you know, has certainly fed into this, as well as, you know, there's other factors, like the baby boomers are retiring. Those who were born in 1960 became eligible for retirement, and that's the last year of the baby boomers. So it's a confluence of a lot of things, but I mean, we have to respect these individuals as the professionals and the experts they are. We have to pay them. It shouldn't be charity. And when we don't do that, when we don't respect these individuals in our schools, they leave, and young people decide they're not going to go into teaching, or they're not going to go into administration, or, you know, school support. And again, this is all in the context of the Great Resignation, but, you know, everybody's facing staffing challenges right now.
Superintendent Underley, thank you for joining us.
You're very, very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Jill Underley is State Superintendent of Public Instruction in Wisconsin, elected to the role in April 2021. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.